off on your travels and let Ring's wide range of easy-to-install smart home security devices, which include security cameras, video doorbells, and alarms, stand guard over your property and valuables while you're away. All devices can be monitored via the Ring app, meaning you can easily confirm all is well simply by checking the live video feed on your phone or smart device. For more information on Ring devices, visit Takealot, Incredible Connection, and Hersh's. With Ring, you're always home. Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbracht, and you're listening to a Rewind episode. What are Rewind episodes, you may ask? Well, they're really just a way to revisit older episodes that you may have missed. True Crime South Africa has more than 180 episodes right now. And although many of you may have listened to each and every one twice, many episodes seem to have been lost in the wave of new content. New episodes take a ton of research time, and I can't always balance a brand new one every single week with all the other stuff. So occasionally I'll be encouraging a review of TCSA's back catalogue with these Rewind episodes. But it's not just the same episode repeated again. In many cases, I'll include a bit of a tack-on at the end with updates on new information I've found or received since the release of that episode. I often get comments about how people going back to my early episodes find it so interesting to hear how much my delivery on the podcast has changed. And through these Rewind episodes, I can definitely hear it too. So keep in mind when you're listening that you're hearing both 2025 Nicole and 2020 Nicole, for instance, in the same episode, which may be a little jarring, but it's also kind of cool. I have no doubt you're going to find a bunch of gem episodes you've never heard among the Rewinds. And I'll be back in between with brand new episodes.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
This episode was first released in the True Crime South Africa feed on the 16th of December 2022. Listen through to the end for a current update. Carmen Nan Lee, who was the mother of Siam Lee, is alternately referred to in the media as both Carmen and Nan. In most sources, and in an interview I listened to with East Coast Radio, she's referred to as Nan, so that's how I'll refer to her in this episode. When she was a child, Nan had attended a boarding school in Pietermaritzburg called Wickham Collegiate School for Girls. She did not matriculate, however, and left school before that to travel to Asia. Nan had been a dancer in many different styles throughout her childhood, and she'd been set up with an opportunity to work in dance in Asia, so that was a very young Nan's destination. Nan would end up living in Hong Kong, but by that point, she was no longer working as a dancer. At some point in her time in Asia, Nan had become involved in the sex trade, and was working as what she described as an escort. Now, sex work plays a major role in this case, so let's address this up front. People like to look down upon those who work in the sex trade, as though they are somehow above the women and men who work in this industry. Many men and women do find themselves in the sex trade because of difficulties in their lives, and would likely have chosen differently if circumstances had been different. Perhaps it's also important to define exactly what a sex worker is, because it's not just one thing. And I don't think most people understand the vast continuum that is the sex industry. Sex work is essentially any transaction in which someone exchanges services of a sexual or erogenous nature
for money or other agreed forms of payment. The exchange of services doesn't need to be physical, though. People who work in the pornography industry, on phone sex lines, and even people with adult content OnlyFans accounts are all technically considered sex workers. Sidebar, when people ask me what Patreon is, I often describe it as OnlyFans without the porn. And if you don't know what OnlyFans is, it's basically Patreon with the option of porn. When most people hear the term sex worker, they picture a reed-thin woman, probably addicted to some substance, standing on a street corner because she has no other choice, and exchanging sexual acts for money. But this couldn't be further from the truth. The sex industry is the oldest on Earth. It is a vast continuum of both people forced into these situations and people who choose to sell erotic photographs, for instance, because they enjoy creating them and they want a side hustle. Now, before anyone accuses me of glamorizing sex work, I am not doing that. I know sex workers. I personally know women and men who work in different areas in this industry. For the vast majority of people, it is not something they would be doing if they had any other choice. But for many, it is something they choose, and that deserves to be acknowledged too. Not something you would do? No problem. No one's asking you to. Just listen without judgments if you can. Nan's story, and ultimately Siam's, will be intricately tied up with the side of this industry that no one ever talks about. The clients. The mostly men, and admittedly women too, who use services provided by the sex industry. Why does no one ever talk about the clients? Well, for a lot of reasons. Sex is still considered so taboo, and really, no one wants to admit that someone they know is actively promoting the sex industry, do they? No. It's much easier to pretend sex workers are providing these services that so many find so scandalous to, I don't know, Casper the Ghost? The women are doing all the so-called bad stuff, and the recipients of these services are completely invisible and free from any stigma. Seems totally fair, right? Well, in this episode, we're going to be discussing at least two clients of this industry, and they played a role in both Nan and Siam's lives. The first man is Howard Greenspan, who met Nan in Hong Kong. Howard was a businessman from Cape Town who worked in Hong Kong, and at one point he was a client of Nan's. It is not uncommon for sex workers to form long-term interactions with their clients. Most prefer to keep it superficial and as a straight business transaction. But longer-term relationships have been known to develop, and this appeared to have been the case with Nan and Howard. Now, in articles which later refer to Howard, he's said to have been divorced, and we have no way of knowing exactly what context his relationship with Nan fit into, and really, it doesn't actually matter. What does matter is that in 1996, Nan fell pregnant with Howard's child. It appears that there would be some form of agreement between Nan and Howard that he would financially support the child and a trust fund would be set up to pay for her education. When Siam was born on the 15th of April 1997, though, she did not take her father's surname and instead became Siam Lee. Most of the people I spoke to for this episode also mentioned that they had never known Siam to have a relationship with her father, so it certainly seems that Howard took financial responsibility for the child, but did not actively participate in her life. At this point, I should probably tell you that I did attempt to make contact with Nan, but was unable to reach her. I know that she has struggled significantly since her daughter's murder, and perhaps she would not be in the best space to participate in a project of this nature anyway. So all the information I have about her and Siam's life comes from the people who knew them, interviews she gave with the media, and social media commentary that I could verify as being trustworthy. For Nan, the fact that Howard was not in her daughter's life did not appear to be a huge issue. She seemed to be doing well for herself and Siam in Hong Kong, and describes the first 5 years of Siam's childhood as idyllic. She says they travelled a lot, and she had a nanny that looked after Siam while she was working. Nan also says that Siam had no idea what her mother's occupation was at this young age. At some point, it seems that Nan decided that Siam would be better off starting her school career in South Africa. She'd attended a Montessori preschool in Hong Kong, but when she turned 7, she would need to officially start primary school, and this was perhaps a major factor in Nan's decision to move back to South Africa when Siam was 5. Mother and daughter moved to KwaZulu-Natal in 2002, and although Nan still worked in the sex trade, she also supplemented her income by renting out rooms and a house to students. This commune-type lifestyle was definitely well-suited to the free-spirited Nan, and Siam would definitely be deeply impacted by her less-than-ordinary childhood, and not all of these impacts were negative. Siam seemed to be a really well-rounded child. She and her mother were extremely close, and Siam also took on this free-spirited nature, not really seeming too concerned about society's expectations of how she should behave. I know that many have struggled to understand the relationship between Nan and Siam, but I don't think I'm one of those people. I think I quite deeply understand it, because I've seen this exact dynamic play out in front of me in people I personally know. I've seen this deep bond between a single mother and her daughter, and how that is affected when the mother lives an alternative lifestyle to the norm and works in the sex trade. Of course, the people I know are different human beings to Siam and Nan, so it's not exactly the same. But I do think that many of the aspects would be similar. We don't know when Siam became aware that her mother worked in the sex trade. It very likely was not a single conversation that imparted this information to her. It was probably small things, mentions, and leakage of information over time. At some point, though, she would have known that the secret was not to be shared outside the home. Even if Nan was not ashamed of her work, she would have very well known that others would not react positively. And if Siam's school friends knew what her mother did, she would very likely be bullied. So there's this contrast. Knowing and loving your mother and seeing her as a good human being and being grateful for the fact she provides for you. But then there's the secret. As a child, say under 12, you would just know it as information that the outside world wouldn't accept the same way you do. As Siam got older, though, and perhaps really began to understand what sex work actually was, she would have had a better understanding of why she had to keep that secret. But there would still be those opposing views. She is living on the inside of the secret, and she doesn't see her mother as any different from anyone else's mom. But the outside world wouldn't feel the same. She may have started to recognize when people used slurs to describe sex workers in conversation, that people like her mom were not viewed favorably in the vast majority of society. And who is she going to side with? Of course she's going to side with her mom. To Siam, her mom is just her mom. Whatever she does to earn money doesn't really impact her relationship with her. But as I've seen in similar relationships I've personally witnessed, this childhood secret holding and desire to protect her mother from retribution does often build an extremely strong bond. Nan actually doesn't appear to have been that different from many other single moms. She made many mistakes, she says, but she always tried to ensure that Siam was having a normal childhood. For Siam, though, even though she may not have consciously recognized it, the very fact that it was just the two of them and there was this secret that had to be kept meant that she would never really have been a child. She would have always felt some sort of responsibility toward her mother that perhaps didn't fit the standard mother-daughter dynamic. Siam's friends told me that she was extremely close to her mother and almost never spoke about arguing with her outside of the ordinary tiffs children and teenagers have with their parents. Their seemingly extraordinary bond would become a major factor in what later happened to Siam, though, and stood in stark contrast to what the world chose to see about their relationship. I would like to point out that, in my view at least, this intense responsibility that Siam felt toward her mother and the deep bond they had was not necessarily healthy. And I say this only because I've seen how it can play out in terms of the child taking far too much responsibility for the parent. It's a form of codependency, really, and will almost always have negative consequences for both the child and the parent. But it's also something that happens very often. While Nan was still working to provide for her and her daughter, Siam's education at least was paid for by her father, and she would go on to attend excellent schools in KZN, including Crawford International College on the North Coast, for high school, where she would meet many of the friends who ultimately reached out to me. Siam soon proved that she was a gifted student. Her mother, at one point, would say that the girl's IQ had tested at 127, which is certainly considered above average. While Siam was still in primary school, though, in 2005, when she was just 8 years old, the young girl experienced a significant event in her life. Her father, Howard Greenspan, was murdered. The limited reporting around the crime says that Howard, who by that time was 52 years old, divorced and living alone in a luxury apartment in Clifton, Cape Town, was found shot to death in his home. A 28-year-old female was arrested at his apartment, and the articles available seem to allude to the fact that this woman may have been a sex worker. There are no follow-up articles to this, and I cannot find any judgments in murder cases that contain Howard's name, so I cannot conclusively say whether anyone was ever found guilty of this crime. Now, as I've said, it doesn't appear that Siam really had any type of relationship with her father, but there are so many weird parallels in their deaths, which I'll discuss in more detail a little later. For now, you should know and keep in mind that Howard Greenspan was murdered on the 4th of January, 2005. After Howard's death, Nan would later say that she'd struggled for years to ensure that Siam was, quote, given her dues, as she phrased it. I don't know whether Howard had included Siam in his will or if he had other children, but the eventual results of what Nan said was a protracted battle was a trust fund that was created which would pay Siam's education costs. One would think that the terms of that agreement would have included how long the payments would continue for and whether it would cover tertiary education. But this would become the source of much debate later. In 2011, when Siam was 14, Nan briefly considered moving to Bloemfontein. She'd been renting out part of her house to students, and the college they attended relocated campuses, so she'd lost a huge amount of income. In her own words, she wanted to enroll her daughter in a boarding school in KZN, which she thought would offer her more structure. And then she herself would move to Bloemfontein and find a farmer. I say that with a bit of a teasing tone, because although I'm sure that there are many farmers who would have gladly welcomed the attractive blonde into their home, I somehow don't think free-spirited Nan would have lasted very long as a farmer's wife. Just a hunch I have. Thankfully, the boarding school that Nan had chosen to enroll Siam into had talked her out of the idea. They explained that boarding schools were not the same as when Nan had attended one. These days, children went home at weekends, and Siam would be very lonely if she had to stay at school on the weekends and couldn't see her mother for extended periods. Although Siam was very intelligent and excelled at her schoolwork, she was already quite a handful, because, like her mother, she didn't do well following the norms of society. And the school was concerned she would become bored at boarding school, and a bored 14-year-old is never a good thing. Siam's friend at the high school she did end up attending, Crawford College, North Coast, soon gravitated toward the girl. And I'll read you two pieces written by two of those friends a little later in the episode, where they share their memories of Siam. Siam had grown up into a beautiful young lady. She wore her curly brown hair long and flowing, and her pale blue eyes stood out in photographs. She dressed in a way that I can only assume was uniquely Siam. She really did have a bit of a hippie vibe about her, and seemed far more concerned with being comfortable and happy than following any fashion trends or concerning herself with the male gaze. Siam had both a Facebook and Instagram account, and the photos of her on there are artistic and deep. Scrolling through them really gives you a good idea of who she was and what she stood for. It also all seems really mature. There are no goofy, silly posing pictures you might expect to see on a teenager's social media account. Siam was all depth and mood. One post reads, quote, "Why should I have to alter the natural state of my body to be seen as socially acceptable?" End quote. Siam was already clearly very comfortable with her body, and I think that spoke to the environment she grew up in as well. Nan had made a living out of understanding and capitalizing on her sexuality, and I don't say that in a negative way. That's just what she'd done, and how she felt about herself, and Siam had clearly grown up feeling entirely comfortable in her own skin. The photographs on her Instagram account when she was still a teenager sometimes border on erotic. And some might say it isn't something teenage girls should be doing, and perhaps they shouldn't. But for Siam, it wasn't a way of getting attention. At least that's not how it comes across to me. She wasn't showing off or trying to portray herself as a sexual being. She was creating art. And her body was the palette. Unlike many teenage girls who may post what some consider to be questionable photos on their social media, Siam doesn't come across as saying, "Here, look at these boobs I have," in a desperate plea for attention. She actually seemed to deeply understand how a woman's sexuality is so often used as a weapon against her. When she was just 18 years old, she posted the following quote, which is quite long, but I think it gives an interesting insight into this young woman who was clearly far older in her mind than her biological years. Quote, "Rather than fighting for every woman's right to feel beautiful, I would like to see the return of a kind of feminism that tells women and girls everywhere that maybe it's all right not to be pretty and perfectly well-behaved. that maybe women who are plain or large or old or differently abled, or who simply don't give a damn what they look like because they're too busy saving the world or rearranging their sock drawer, have just as much right to take up space as anyone else. I think if we want to take care of the next generation of girls, we should reassure them that power, strength, and character are more important than beauty, and always will be. And that even if they aren't thin or pretty, they are still worthy of respect. That feeling is the birthright of men everywhere. It's about time we claimed it for ourselves. End quote. Now, Siam didn't write that. It's credited to Love is a Dirty Word blog, but it's one of the few text pieces she has on her Instagram account. And I think it's quite remarkable that a girl of her age resonated with something like that. So why am I drilling down so deep into all the facets of Siam's life? What she thought of society and feminism and what the world thought of her? Well, this is a victim-focused podcast, but there's more to it in this case. From this point in this episode, we don't have much time left with Siam. And when she's taken, she will be turned into a single-faceted representation of the type of victim South Africa and maybe the world wanted her to be. She will be described in just a few different terms, and they all refer to one small part of her life. And that is not how this young woman should be remembered. So that's why we're diving so deeply into all the bits that made up this young woman that was Siam Lee. Because I want you to know her before we lose her, like all those people who reached out to me. One of the most interesting things for me when I research cases is drawing up a timeline of both the victim's life and the offender's life in the days, months, and years before a violent crime incident. Because when the violent crime happens, especially if it's a relative stranger crime, we sit back and go, wow, how did that happen? It's just the sudden horrible convergence of circumstances that brought these two people onto the same path with this terrible outcome. But it isn't really. Hardly ever. When I draw up these timelines, I get to see what one person was doing when the other was doing something else, even before they knew each other. And it's interesting to me, and often quite scary, how these escalations happen, and how their paths slowly move together, until they collide. So at this point, I want to do exactly that. I want to start painting a picture for you of where Siam Lee was, and where a man called Philani Thuli was. If you've even a passing knowledge of this case, you will know that Philani Thuli was the man who would eventually be accused of Siam Lee's murder. Sebolenkosi Gift Philani Thuli was a well-educated, well-spoken, successful young man in his late 20s. He was a biochemist, and his name is on several research articles related to biofuels and alternative energy sources. He didn't want to work in research, though. Philani had aspirations to business and had started collecting funding for a business he intended to build around biofuels. Philani is a close relative of the MEC for Health at the time, Dr. Sibongiseni Dhlomo, and owned a very nice home in Assegai, a suburb of eThekwini. In 2014, Philani started a relationship with former Miss Teen South Africa runner-up, Lucky Mthembu. On a program called Unpacked, which is available on YouTube, Lucky tells the story of her relationship with Philani. She recounts how Pilani had almost immediately become very controlling. She'd moved in with him, and that was when the physical abuse had started. Lucky says that she struggled through more than a year of emotional, financial, and physical abuse before deciding in early 2016 that she needed to leave Pilani. As is very common in domestic violence situations, when she made this decision, she found herself at the greatest risk of all. Lucky laid charges related to an assault that occurred at Pilani's home in 2016 when she broke up with him. She would also lay further charges after that relating to Pilani's continued stalking and harassment of her. After quite a struggle, Lucky managed to obtain a protection order against Pilani, and when she did, she says he turned his rage to her family. I want to be very clear that what I am about to relay is not my opinion or something I have knowledge of. It is a repetition of what Lucky Mtembu has told several journalists and included in an 11-page report about Pilani's behavior toward her. Shortly after she obtained the protection order against Pilani Ntuli, Lucky Mtembu's mother's car was set alight in the driveway outside her home. Then, not long after, Lucky's mother was murdered while coming out of her place of work. The case was never solved, and Lucky has been very vocal about her beliefs that her ex, Pilani Ntuli, was behind both the car fire and the murder. She says after her mother was killed, there were still occasional incidents of harassment from Ntuli, but he eventually seemed satisfied he'd caused as much damage as he could. In May 2016, Lucky Mtembu had recovered enough strength after her ordeal with Ntuli that she decided to press forward with her action against him. She says that the charges she laid with police were never followed up, and each time she complained that he was violating the protection order, no action was taken against him. As such, the young woman took a bold step. She says that although she was now completely separated from Ntuli and could have just moved on with her life, her fear was that he would do this to someone else. And perhaps he was capable of even worse if her suspicions about his involvement in her mother's murder were true. As a result, she used the public platform she'd built through her modeling and business ventures to pen an 11-page letter to Police Minister Fikile Mbalula. She released it publicly and detailed all of the abuse she'd suffered and accused police of allowing a predator to walk the streets where he could easily harm other women. At the time, the report got some press coverage. Ntuli's government minister relative had even reached out to him and asked him to respond to the accusations being made against him. He denied it all, and no action was taken by the police against Pilani Ntuli. In fact, instead of backing off, Ntuli restarted his campaign of terrorism against Lucky by creating a website on which he essentially used so-called revenge porn to shame Lucky. Still, his actions remained unaddressed by police. While Pilani Ntuli was allegedly conducting the significantly abusive relationship with Lucky Mtembu, Siam Lee was finishing high school and coming to a sudden and rather shocking realization. Nan would say that the problems with the trust fund had already started in Siam's matric year, but she'd managed to get them to pay for her daughter's school fees until she finished school. Nan, though, and by extension her daughter, seemed to have been under the impression that the trust fund from her father would pay for her tertiary education as well. But it soon became clear that wasn't going to happen. I honestly don't know what went wrong here. I don't know if there was only enough money to cover primary and high school and the money ran out, or perhaps the agreement was always that Siam's education would only be funded until she turned 18. It is strange to me that there was no documentary evidence of what the actual agreement was. It would seem cruel to get Siam's hopes up that she would have a funded tertiary education if that was never guaranteed. I don't know what the actual problem was, but I do wonder if Nan, being the free-spirited and perhaps not detail-oriented person that she was, had made assumptions and not actually asked the question. She would later say that the lawyer that ran the trust fund had questions to answer as it related to what happened to Siam. Not having much detail, I can't say whether that's fair or not, but it does feel like a stretch. Siam matriculated with good results. Her mother said that her dream was to qualify as a teacher and then go back to Hong Kong to work. But when she discovered that she didn't have any funding for her education, those plans had to change. Siam began working various jobs to earn money. She waitressed, tended bar, did promotion work and modelled. Really, a very normal way for a young person to be starting their life. Nan says, though, that she watched as Siam began to fade away during this time. She says that her daughter saw all of her friends heading off to university and she was unable to do so. Now, I can fully understand Siam, being a young person, may have seen this disappointment as quite severe. I think we can all look back at our teens and early 20s and recognize how we thought things not going to plan were huge events that impacted us so greatly. But really, not being able to study at university is not the end of the world. And many people study by correspondence while working or just jump straight into the working world. I will acknowledge that Siam, having gone to a private school where most of her friends were likely from well-off families, would have made a difference. There probably weren't very many of her schoolmates who didn't have fixed plans for their lives after school, whether that was university, a gap year travelling, or something else equally exciting. But this wasn't anything new to Siam. She had spent her entire school life in this dichotomy of being the less privileged girl among her peers. I might be badgering on the point now, but much would be made of it later, so I want to explore it a bit here before we get there. While Siam was navigating this change of plans in her life, the man she had not yet met had become the subject of a new complaint. In 2016, a young woman who would be referred to as Kate was abducted and raped. Although the young woman had not wanted to press charges against her assailant at the time, her parents had approached a man who would later play a pivotal role in this case one Sunday morning after church. Brad Nathanson is a private investigator based in KwaZulu-Natal. He's quite well known, has worked on several high-profile cases, and knows his province and its criminal elements like the back of his hand. In 2016, Kate's parents approached him with the horrifying tale of what their daughter had experienced at the hands of an unknown man who had called himself Oscar. Due to the confidential nature of rape cases, it was never 100% confirmed whether Kate had been working in the sex trade at the time, nor does it really matter. But some sources have inferred this, and it would speak to a pattern of victim selection. Kate said that she'd been abducted by gunpoint by the man who called himself Oscar. He made her undress and lie naked behind the front and passenger seats and in front of the back seats of his Mercedes coupe before driving into his garage and closing the door behind him. He then dragged Kate from the car and straight into his kitchen via a garage and then into a bedroom. Over the next few hours, Kate was raped and belittled by the man. She was eventually able to convince him to let her go by promising that she wouldn't report the abduction and rape to anyone, including the police. She'd eventually told her parents what had happened, but refused point blank to open a case at the police station. Kate's parents were concerned about this man walking the streets, though. Even if their own daughter just wanted to move on with her life, they felt that this man needed to be brought under someone's attention. Kate couldn't provide a surname for the man who'd abducted her, but she was able to tell Brad that the house she was taken from was in a road, perhaps aptly named, Controversy Road, in Assegai. Brad took Kate and they drove up and down the road. She initially identified a house she thought she'd been taken to, but considering she'd been forced to stay down between the seats, she'd only seen glimpses of the outside, and it would later emerge that the house she'd been in was actually next door to the house she initially identified. 2 years later, she would be walked through the house of Pilani Ntuli, who lived on Controversy Road, and she identified it as the home she'd been brought to during her ordeal. I must reiterate, though, that Kate would never have the opportunity to prove her claims in court, and as such, we have to consider that, at least in a legal sense, Ntuli is only accused and not convicted of this crime. While Kate was recovering from her ordeal at the hands of the man she believed was Pilani Ntuli, Siam and her mother were entering a difficult period in their lives. As 2016 faded away and 2017 dawned, Siam was still working odd jobs, holding on to the hope that she would be able to make her dreams come true. She was still living with her mom, who was working as a sex worker in an establishment close to their home. In 2017, Nan and a colleague got into an argument, which soon turned heated. The two women engaged in a physical altercation, and during this fight, Nan was burned with scalding water. She sustained severe burns to large parts of her body. These injuries soon became badly infected, which extended her recovery process significantly. Nan was unable to work while she recovered, and the money that Siam was bringing in was simply not enough to cover all of their joint costs. Nan and Siam were evicted from their home after not being able to pay the rent for several months, and the owner of the establishment Nan worked at agreed to let both women move in there. It's not uncommon for establishments that facilitate sex work to allow their workers to live on the premises. Some workers will live there permanently, while others will only stay over while they're working. It's around this time that Nan says one of the other women living at the house had asked Siam why she wasn't working in the sex trade. This suggestion had seemed to spark some thought in Siam, and soon she was telling her mom that she thought it might be a good way for her to earn money. Nan says that she resisted Siam's suggestion for a long time, but her daughter was persistent, and she eventually relented with one condition. Nan wanted to be present at any bookings her daughter took. Nan also says that at no time was Siam ever providing a full sexual experience to clients. In other words, she was not having complete penetrative sex. The service Nan says that her daughter provided was essentially erotic massage. It may be easy for us to assume that Nan was simply trying to make the situation seem less seedy than it was after the fact, but there is some proof to support what Nan was saying. The women working from the sex work establishment in Durban North, where Nan and Siam worked, mostly advertised on a website called redvelvet.com. The page advertising both Nan and Siam services was screenshotted and is still available on the internet today. It shows both Nan and Siam posed in erotic positions, Nan in lingerie and Siam in panties, but topless. Women in the sex trade hardly ever work under their real names, for obvious reasons. And Siam and her mother had chosen the moniker Student in Training for Siam. The story behind this moniker would lead into the idea that Nan was present for any appointment Siam had. The ad clearly details the services that Siam was prepared to offer and ends with the words, "No FH available." FH stands for Full House. Full house is a term used in the sex trade to describe a full penetrative sexual act between a client and a sex worker. So this ad does seem to support Nan's claim that Siam was not having intercourse with clients for money. And to be honest, that doesn't really matter to me at all. I know for some people it might make a difference, but I've never been one to judge people by how they choose to engage with their bodies. What this advert does do, though, and what it would do for many people, is place Nan Lee directly in the firing line of blame after her daughter's murder. For me, though, I see this a little differently. Many people may feel that Siam was groomed into this by her mother, and while we'll never really know whether that's true or not, the dynamic of this type of parent-child relationship I discussed earlier really comes into play here. Nan would say that Siam had been doing the sensual massages to save up money to study. But I think the codependent nature of this mother and daughter's relationship probably meant that wasn't entirely true. Siam likely felt like she had to step up to help both her mother and herself. Now, while for most of us, sex work seems like a last resort, Siam had grown up in a world where there were varying degrees of interactions with clients, and all of them made you far more money than a waitressing job. So, in perhaps a slightly dark way, it actually seems natural that Siam would not have felt averse to the idea of offering certain services for money. And I'm very sure she did so more to be of assistance to her mother than to save up for her studies. Nan probably never asked her to do this. But we have to remember that these two women live in a very different world to the rest of us. Another young person faced with a similar predicament might get a job at a pizza joint, because sex work simply isn't even on their radar. But in Siam's world, it was pretty normal. She'd known about her own mother's sex work for a long time, and still deeply loved and respected her. She'd become friendly with many of her mother's co-workers, and was able to see them as the human beings they were. For her, while sex work was certainly not ideal, there wasn't a brick wall between the idea and her thoughts. All possibilities coexisted in the same universe. Despite this, it soon became clear that Siam had been a little naive about the deep emotional impact this type of work can have on a person. Nan presents with a pretty tough exterior, and it's likely that Siam had never really seen the damage the work had done to her mother over the years. By September 2017, though, it became clear that Siam was not handling the work she was doing on an emotional level. After her murder, an advocacy organization that works with sex workers would come forward to tell police that Siam had reached out to them. One of the counselors recounted that Siam had expressed that she was emotionally broken from the work she was doing and didn't know how much longer she would be able to do it. Siam reached out to this organization regularly throughout the months that followed and sometimes donated her old clothes so that they could be distributed to other women who were struggling. In October 2017, the two paths we've been tracking so far finally crossed. Pilani Ntuli booked a sensual massage with Siam Lee, and they met for the first time. In October 2017, Pilani Ntuli saw Siam's advert on the Red Velvet website and booked a sensual massage with her. Nan Lee says that no alarm bells went off when she first met Ntuli. She said he was well-spoken, friendly, and had a very wide smile. To her, he seemed no different than the countless other successful businessmen who frequented the establishment she'd worked at. And while neither she nor Siam seemed to really have any major impression of the man beyond an ordinary appointment, he did seem to find this initial meeting particularly important. Ntuli took a significant interest in Siam almost immediately, and soon after this first meeting, he requested a dinner date with her. This is another service that's offered within the range of sex work or escort services. Sometimes clients just need a woman to accompany them to either a specific function or they want to have dinner with them. Depending on the worker in question, this may or may not end in other services being offered. Nan says that the dinner date was just that, dinner. Ntuli arrived at the house in his black Mercedes Viano. Nan calls the vehicle a loaf of bread, and I guess it does look like one. She says that she introduced herself as student in training's mother and indicated that her daughter should be back by 10 p.m. and no later. Ntuli had agreed, and he and Siam set off. Nan says that Siam had returned at the stipulated time, but the minute she'd walked through the door, she declared she never wanted to see Ntuli again. She described him as weird and creepy. Nan says she laughed it off at the time, figuring they probably wouldn't see the man again, but this was not to be. Soon after the dinner date, Ntuli continued to message Siam and request additional appointments with her. I did really want to find out exactly how frequently he'd been messaging her and what the nature of the messages were. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find out much about that in the public domain, but many sources do say that Ntuli became quite irritating to Siam. We also don't know for sure whether she actually saw him again after that dinner date, but it seems clear she did not feel comfortable around him. Another thing I wondered was how Ntuli got Siam's direct number. The advert on Red Velvet clearly says that no private DMs or calls would be entertained, and surely the entire point of running through a service like that and working out of an establishment like the one in Durban North is to maintain as much anonymity and protection as possible. But Ntuli did have Siam's number, and he used it as much as he could. Throughout November and December 2017, it's alleged that Ntuli's pursuit of Siam continued. I'm certain that if this case had made it to court, more information would have come forth about the nature of these messages and her reaction to them, but that was not to be. Although Ntuli remains only an accused in this case, we can look at the type of behaviour Lucky Mtembu says he displayed toward her and I think draw some decently accurate conclusions about what Siam may have been experiencing at that time. The sex workers' advocacy organisation last heard from Siam Lee on the 26th of December 2017, when she reached out to the counsellor she'd been chatting with to say she had some clothing she wanted to donate. On the 31st of December 2017, Siam and her mom attended a dance festival in Durban to ring in the new year. Siam seems to have picked up a virus at this festival and fell ill. On the 2nd of January, she posted on her Instagram page with photographs of her, her mom, and an unidentified older male at a river where they seemed to be enjoying a day out. Siam said it was a lovely day, but her immune system had let her down and she wasn't feeling well. At some point between the 31st of December 2017 and the 4th of January 2018, it's believed that Siam had had enough of Pilani Ntuli's incessant messages and requests to meet up with her, and she told him in no uncertain terms that she wanted nothing more to do with him. At around 3 p.m. on the 4th of January 2018, CCTV outside the house where Siam and her mom were living in Durban North shows a black Mercedes-Benz Viano with Gauteng number plates pulling into the driveway of the home and entering the premises. There are two stories in the public domain about what happened next. One is that Siam was standing outside the house, barefoot and wearing a flowing summer dress, when the black Mercedes van pulled up. The driver got out, armed with a gun, forced Siam into his vehicle and drove off. The other story is that Siam was in her room when her abductor arrived. He forced his way into the house, went to her room and took her from there into his vehicle. I tend to think that the former story is the more accurate one, because it appears more frequently in reporting around Siam's case and seems more plausible. It is entirely possible that the driver of the van had had contact with Siam at some point that day, perhaps told her to wait outside the house as he wanted to speak with her or give her something, and then when he'd arrived, he'd forced her into the vehicle. Siam was not wearing shoes, so it's clear she did not intend to leave with the driver of the vehicle that day. Because this case did not end up being presented in court, the minute details about when she was reported missing, what information was initially given to police, and the like, are not in the public domain, but we can draw some relatively fair conclusions from the information that is available, although many questions remain unanswered. Several sources say that one of Siam's co-workers had witnessed her abduction. I don't know whether police were called at that very moment or whether Nan Lee was at the house when it happened. Another aspect that's never been clarified is whether anyone actually thought about Pilani Ntuli as a suspect at this early stage. I tend to think that he was either not actually on anyone's radar or the people at the house didn't know his real name. In early reports of Siam's disappearance, the description of the vehicle is given, but it just says the vehicle has GP number plates, and some articles say that the registration number of the vehicle was not visible on CCTV footage. Although we do not have certain details of the police reaction to the missing persons report about Siam, it certainly seems, and Nan would later say, that in the early hours and days of her disappearance, police didn't seem to react with the vigour that her family and friends would have expected. The reason I say this is that within days of Siam's disappearance, both family members of hers who lived in Australia and Nan Lee herself had employed the services of two different private investigators to work on her case. Brad Nathanson was reportedly contacted by Siam's father's family in Australia, which I found quite interesting and wondered how that came about. Her friends that I spoke to didn't mention her having spoken of a relationship with her paternal family, so I considered that perhaps Nan, in her desperation to find Siam, had contacted the family for financial assistance, and they decided to appoint a PI themselves, perhaps to have closer control of how the investigation was handled. Nan, though, would end up approaching a different organisation called MobiClaw for help, and both organisations would carry out investigations into Siam's disappearance with varying, though equally interesting, outcomes. On the 7th of January, Nan, accompanied by her close friend, appeared in a MobiClaw Facebook video pleading for the return of Siam. Although Siam's disappearance was followed intensely by social media users, including her friends and family, the media took some time to pick up on her case. The first real coverage I can find about Siam's disappearance was on the 10th of January. Of course, media coverage predominantly focused on Siam's occupation at the time of her disappearance, with almost none of the articles failing to use the words sex worker or escort as a descriptor in front of her name. Another major focus around this time was the shock of Durban North residents that they had an establishment serving sex work in their neighbourhood. The direct neighbours of the home had, of course, long understood that the home was not an ordinary family setup, but sordid descriptions of this hidden house of ill repute in a leafy suburban area peppered many of the earlier articles around this case. So this became the focus. And when it became known that Siam's mother, Nan, was also a sex worker, and allegations were made that she'd groomed her daughter into the trade, the sensation exploded, and along with it, the judgment of Siam and her mother. Much of the public vitriol was targeted at Nan for what many saw as her having put her daughter in harm's way. More than 10 days would pass without any word on Siam's disappearance, but then several things would happen at once that would fast-track the investigation and an eventual arrest. Now, if you have any passing knowledge of this case, you may have wondered why, considering where we are in the timeline, I haven't mentioned Siam's body having been recovered yet. And this was one of the big surprises I got when I started researching this case. The general idea that would come from later reporting would be that Siam went missing and her body was found and the arrest was made. But that's not really what happened. Police and private investigators were still searching for a missing Siam Lee as late as the 12th of January. On the morning of the 7th of January, though, a farmer and his grandson who were walking through a cane field in New Hanover, 100 kilometres from where Siam had disappeared, made a gruesome discovery. The pair came across a badly burned body of what was eventually determined to be a young female. Police were called and the scene was photographed, and the remains were eventually removed and sent to a mortuary for autopsy and identification. And now you might be thinking what I am, right? Well, I'm sure considering Siam's disappearance had become such big news, someone within the SAPS had gone, okay, young female is missing, here's the body of a young female, let's see if it's our missing person. Well, no, that's not what happened. What actually happened is that a few days after the discovery, a photographer from Times Live, Jackie Clausen, was in court on assignment. She was tasked with taking photographs of a case that was in court that day, and during a break, she happened to overhear a rather disturbing conversation. Two police officers stood waiting for a case they were to testify in to be called, and they were discussing the case of a young female who'd been found deceased and with her remains burned in New Hanover on the 7th. From the sound of it, the condition of the deceased was particularly terrible. But the cops mentioned one thing that got Jackie's brain ticking. The deceased victim had a piercing in her lip. Now, photographers have a keen eye for detail. There's no doubt about that. And they'll see things in photographs that many others won't. Jackie could not help but think about the photographs she'd seen of Siam Lee, because she too had a piercing in her bottom lip. At the time, the officers had moved on, and Jackie had gone back to her task at hand. But the information continued to niggle at her, and when she got back to the office, she approached her boss. They both agreed that there was something to this, and it was important to make sure the police had also made this connection. It turned out they hadn't. Not yet, at least, and maybe they would have eventually, or maybe they wouldn't. By that point, the unidentified victim had already been laying in the morgue for several days, and the major identifying characteristic, a relatively uncommon piercing, had not been a factor that had been searched against missing person reports. It was a characteristic that appears in every single one of the missing person posters about Siam from that time, so we know it was in the police report, but it took an eagle-eyed photographer to spot it, and only by chance, because she was in exactly the right place at the right time to overhear that conversation. When police discovered that the victim they'd had since the 7th might be Siam Lee, they contacted her family. Although a visual identification would be extremely difficult, considering the unidentified victim had sustained burns to 90% of her body, and there seemed to have been significant head trauma as well, which had damaged her facial features, Nan Lee did go out to the mortuary to attempt to identify the remains. I cannot even imagine the horror of seeing anyone in that condition, never mind someone who could possibly be your child. Nan explains that although her face was unrecognizable, what had remained of her hair, as well as one single hand that had been protected from burns and bore nail polish that Nan knew Siam liked to wear, told her that this was almost certainly her daughter. DNA would later confirm that the remains found in the cane field in New Hanover that day did indeed belong to Siam Lee. The young woman had experienced significant blunt force trauma to her face and significant burns to her body. Again, as there would never be a court case around this, we do not have a pathologist's report that was read into evidence. Some sources claimed that the autopsy had found smoke in Siam's lungs, indicating, horrifyingly, that she may have still been breathing when her body was set alight. Although these sources still appear when you search for information around this case, almost all the articles that refer to this have either been removed or archived, so I can only wonder whether this information was actually correct, and I truly hope it was not. As Siam's family and friends reeled with the knowledge that the young woman had been so brutally murdered, in the background, a lead was coming in that would break the case wide open. A man who'd been driving in Durban North, just two streets away from the house Siam was abducted from, phoned Brad Nathanson to say he'd been involved in a car accident with a black Mercedes panel van around 3 p.m. on the 4th of January. The man said that the van had ploughed into him after skipping a stop street and then fled the scene. He chased after the van and ended up crashing into the back of it in an attempt to stop him. The van had sped away, though, and he'd lost the man. Brad Nathanson reported on his Facebook page that upon receiving this tip, he'd used information from an insurance company to identify the address to which the vehicle had been registered. He also says that the vehicle was not registered in Pilani Ntuli's name, but the minute he brought the house up on Google, he realized it was one of the houses that he and Kate had looked at back in 2016, when they were looking for the place she says she was taken to and raped. Nathanson says that this is when he'd put two and two together and realized that the two cases may be linked and the common denominator may be Pilani Ntuli. Between the point of identifying the suspect and his actual arrest, things are a little murky, and Ntuli's defense team would make significant allegations against Nathanson during his bail application, which we'll deal with a little later. On the morning of the 16th of January, though, it is clear that entrance was gained to the property of Pilani Ntuli, and his garage was forced open. Inside the garage, Nathanson found a black Mercedes Viano with Gauteng number plates, which had damage to the front and back of the vehicle. There are pictures on Nathanson's Facebook page of him and his team removing the vehicle from the garage on a flatbed. Now, you may note that I have yet to mention the presence of the police at this scene, and that's only because it's unclear exactly when police actually arrived there and what the extent of their involvement was in the seizures and eventual arrest. Brad Nathanson says unequivocally that everything he did that day was with the consent of the police, and they had been present at Ntuli's house for most of the day. Ntuli was not at the house when they removed the vehicle, though, and Nathanson said that police members had needed to leave the scene to attend to other matters, and they'd tasked Nathanson with watching the house and arresting Ntuli if he arrived. After a few hours of parking slightly down the street watching the house, Nathanson and his team watched as Ntuli arrived home. The man pulled into his driveway and, perhaps noticing that his garage had been forced open, walked over and peered inside. He was met with a gaping empty space where his panel van had once been. Nathanson says that at this point, the man clearly realized something was up and tried to get back into his vehicle, possibly to flee the house. But the team had descended on him and arrested him. There are photographs on Nathanson's Facebook page of the arrest as well. As news of Pilani and Thuli's arrest started to spread, although his name was initially kept confidential because Nathanson had convinced Kate to add her case of rape to the charge sheet, there were glimpses of his identity, and Lucky Mtembu, Pilani's ex-fiancé, came forward regarding her experiences with the man. Lucky was horrified that despite her best efforts to make the police aware of the danger Pilani and Thuli posed to women, he was now being accused of the most horrendous murder. The charges she'd laid almost 3 years before would be transferred and attached to the proposed prosecution of Ntuli for Siam's abduction and murder. Pilani Ntuli would be interviewed by police, and apparently PI Nathanson was present at that interview. It's claimed that certain admissions were made, but it would later become clear that Ntuli was going to plead complete innocence on all charges against him. So we must take that into account from a legal perspective, that any alleged confessions would have been challenged in court at some point. Nathanson says that Ntuli had admitted to abducting Siam, but the reason he gave for the abduction was not a sexually obsessed drive to possess the young woman. Rather, he says Ntuli claimed that when he'd first met Siam, he'd given her a loan of 50,000 rand. He claimed that she hadn't paid it back, and when she'd started ignoring his pleas for the money to be repaid, he decided to teach her a lesson and abducted her. Nathanson says that Ntuli claimed he'd taken Siam to his house in Controversy Road and handcuffed her to a balustrade on a stairwell inside the home and repeatedly raped her. Ntuli claimed that Siam had told him on several occasions during the attack that she was going to go to the police and have him arrested, and this is why he decided to kill her. He claimed that he'd first attempted to strangle her, but this had only caused her to enter some sort of seizure state, and he chillingly says that he thought he'd put her out of her misery, so he placed a piece of material over her head and struck her several times with a hammer. He then loaded her into his Mercedes Viano, drove to a nearby petrol station, and purchased 25 litres of petrol. The ordeal had lasted more than 2 days, with Siam being abducted on the 4th of January at 3 p.m. and eventually being killed, dumped, and her remains set alight in New Hanover on the evening of the 6th of January. Two pieces of evidence would seem to support this version. Although Ntuli did not have a tracking device placed in his car for his own purposes, he was unaware that the Mercedes Viano he owned was factory fitted with a tracking device by Mercedes-Benz. Data from this tracking device placed him in the area of New Hanover on the evening of the 6th of January. The petrol station he'd purchased the petrol from did not have working CCTV cameras, but one of the attendants that worked there knew Ntuli, and he'd confirmed that the man had indeed purchased 25 litres of petrol that day. When Kate agreed to add her case of rape and abduction to Ntuli's charge sheet, she'd been asked to see if she could identify him in an identity parade. She was able to immediately point out Ntuli as the man she'd known as Oscar, who'd abducted and raped her in 2016. She was also able to confirm that the inside of the man's home at Controversy Road was the same home she'd been taken to. Between January and February, Ntuli appeared in court on several more occasions. His charge list grew, and as the additional charges were read out in court, the man shook his head. In March 2018, Siam Lee was eventually laid to rest. Her body had been held for further testing, and in a private send-off with her family and friends present, her ashes were scattered and a memorial service was held. In that same month, Pilani Ntuli began what would become a very protracted bail application. Although no one could know it then, this would also be the only opportunity for most people to hear a lot of the evidence against the man, as well as an idea of what his defence might be. During bail applications, much of the evidence against the accused will be presented so that the judge is able to get a good idea of the case against the defendant. The defendant will then also counter evidence where they can with their own evidence or testimony. Unfortunately, at this early stage, physical evidence is often not yet available, and we would never hear any evidence led about DNA or other physical evidence that may have been found in Ntuli's vehicle or in his home. Brad Nathanson did testify for the state about how he had identified Ntuli as a suspect and his subsequent actions. The defense were quite clearly on the attack with Nathanson and accused him of illegally detaining Ntuli, as well as using torture methods to get a confession out of the man. Nathanson, of course, denied any wrongdoing, saying that any seizures and the arrest were done with the full knowledge and under the instruction of police. Testimony was led that alleged that several illegal searches had been conducted of Ntuli's home, either by Nathanson or the police. It was alleged that no warrant was in place when these searches took place, and as a result, any evidence gained from them could be deemed inadmissible. The state asked the judge not to grant Ntuli bail because they believed he would intimidate witnesses, and they also believed he was a flight risk. Strangely, they also said they couldn't have Ntuli out on bail because they believed that they could find trophies he'd kept from other crimes in his home. The judge, quite rightly I think, asked why almost 4 months after the man's arrest, his home had not been properly searched already. While the bail application was ongoing, Nan Lee was seen in court several times. She spoke to journalists about the horror of hearing about the injuries her daughter had sustained. In May 2018, Nan Lee was arrested for damage to property after the landlord at the place she was living at had refused her entry because she hadn't paid her rent, and the woman had attempted to break her way into the home to get her belongings. She was released on bail after being held for several days. During this time, she'd asked a friend to take the dog that she and Siam had together, a Timberwolf, to a rescue center, as she realized she could no longer look after the animal. The animal was taken to a sanctuary for Timberwolves in Bloemfontein, and Nan says that she hoped to be able to get the dog back when she was settled again because it was one of the last links she had to her daughter. In June 2018, Magistrate Mohamed Murtala passed judgment in the bail application of Pilani Ntuli. His bail would become a significant puzzle piece in the growing mystery around this case, and it also gives a really good rundown of the evidence the state may have had at that stage, and how, as it was alleged, this case may have been bungled. So I'm going to read the judgment to you. Quote, "The state's evidence is that currently the cause of death, the place of death, and the date and time of death are unknown. The state relies on circumstantial evidence that the deceased left with the applicant. 2 days later, her body was found burnt on a farm in New Hanover, and that the applicant's vehicle was tracked to that area." End quote. Motala said that in building their case against the businessman, the state was placing heavy reliance on evidence gathered from the impounding of his car and the search of the man's home. He found that it was common cause, essentially that it was undisputed, that police and investigators, aligned to PI Brad Nathanson, had conducted repeated searches without a warrant. This, he said, could compromise the validity of the evidence and the outcome of his later trial. Quote, "Of fundamental importance in all of this, it is common cause that this all occurred on a normal weekday when the court at Pinetown, which is a short distance from the applicant's home, would have been available to obtain the relevant warrants. Why this was not done beggars belief." End quote. Motala said that while a bail court could not determine admissibility of evidence, it would be considered an exceptional circumstance based on what had been presented before him. He also noted the public outcry which followed Lee's murder, including that a petition to deny bail had been submitted by the state as evidence. Quote, "A court cannot be seen to subvert its role and function at the altar of public opinion, or worse, become part of a lynch mob. As a responsible member of the community and a parent myself, I share in the grief of all those who were near and dear to the young Siam Lee, and it has pained me to listen to the details of her demise. It is hugely important for us as a civilized society that when I sit here, I fulfill the oath and promise of my office, to act without fear or favor or prejudice, and adding to that, without influence of my own personal feelings." End quote. The judge found that the state's circumstantial evidence, coupled with the fact that the alleged murderer presented evidence that many people relied on him to survive, were exceptional circumstances in his favor when it came to bail. Quote, "He personally, or via his business, supports his mother and his brother who is in a private school. According to his testimony, which the state challenged but was not able to disprove, he employs 17 people in the business he runs, thereby providing support for a dozen or more families. Since his incarceration, the employees have not had an income, and given the perilous state of unemployment in our country, one can assume that at least some of them find themselves in trying financial circumstances." End quote. Ntuli was granted bail of 40,000 rand. Now, the judge's summary of the evidence presented thus far is really worrying. But we must consider that when a suspect is arrested, and even when court proceedings begin, the investigation has not necessarily ended. So it is entirely possible that by the time the trial would have started, the state would have had a stronger case. What does really concern me is the mention of what the judge considers common cause, meaning the state does not dispute, that some of the searches conducted in this case were done without a warrant, and there seemed to be no good reason why a warrant was not obtained. I would love the opportunity to get more information about this, but unfortunately I was unable to speak with anyone who could explain why this had occurred. We often see quite long gaps between when a suspect is arrested and a trial starts. This, of course, cannot be unreasonably long, and often there are various reasons for the delay. In Siam's case, by March 2019, a full year and 2 months after her murder, Pilani Ntuli had still not been asked to enter a plea, and he was still out on bail. On the 11th of March 2019, Ntuli attended a court hearing, and he was assaulted by a protester outside the court who allegedly threw a rock at him. For the most part, Ntuli had looked like a healthy young man when he was arrested. Brad Nathanson would reveal that the man was living with the HI virus and that according to him, he hadn't found any antiretroviral medication in his house. This, of course, does not mean that the man was not on ARVs. As the legal proceedings continued, though, Ntuli began to look less and less well. On the 15th of May 2019, he appeared in court on crutches, looking significantly thinner than he had before, and seemed to need to rest quite frequently. At that hearing, a pre-trial date was set for July 2019, but that would never happen. On the 21st of June 2019, reports began to spread that Pilani Ntuli had died. The NPA would later ask for this to be confirmed by means of fingerprints and physical identification, and they soon announced that they were certain that the man was indeed deceased. Reaction to this news was understandably varied. Lucky Mtembu admitted that she simply felt relief. With Ntuli out on bail, she'd been looking over her shoulder, and now she felt she could finally feel safe. Nan Lee initially said she also felt relieved, but then became quite angry, because she felt Ntuli had literally gotten away with murder, and she would never see justice for Siam. In speaking with journalists about this development, she mentioned that she'd always felt that police had let Siam down in the days after her abduction, and that if they had acted quickly, she may have been found alive. She said that now that Ntuli was dead, she was considering taking legal action against the police for what she saw as their failings. For the public, though, many felt that Ntuli's death didn't add up. His lawyer had said that the man had died of skin cancer, and this rather odd fact helped to stir up many conspiracy theories around whether the man had really died or whether he'd faked his death. After Ntuli's arrest, it emerged that besides the violent acts he was accused of, the man was also accused of basically being a bit of a con man. It was alleged by several people that Ntuli had taken their money as investments in a fake petrochemical company and that he'd been involved in several incidents of fraud. This knowledge, of course, only served to fuel the fires of suspicion, as many wondered if Ntuli was a con man, had he perhaps committed the greatest con of all and faked his own death? Brad Nathanson would say on his Facebook page at the time that he believed that Ntuli was dead. I will say, however, that I have been told by someone quite close to this case, who I'll keep anonymous, that they do not believe that Ntuli is dead, although they did not elaborate on exactly why they believe that. The timing of Ntuli's death is certainly suspicious. His pre-trial hearing was due in just a week from the day he died. The man had also never told the court he had cancer, and this would be a pretty helpful piece of information when he was trying to get bail. His lawyer did say that Ntuli had told him he was sick, but he hadn't elaborated on what the nature of his illness was. I think what got people really questioning Ntuli's death was the whole skin cancer thing. We know skin cancer as something relatively non-life-threatening in most cases. Of course, it can spread and then become very dangerous, but generally, if caught early, most forms of skin cancer can be cut out and treated. What is very important to understand, though, is the link between Ntuli having allegedly died of what is referred to as skin cancer and the fact that he was HIV positive. People living with HIV have an increased risk of developing three specific types of cancers. Included in these three is a cancer called Kaposi sarcoma. Kaposi sarcoma is a type of soft tissue sarcoma that has traditionally occurred in older men of Jewish or Mediterranean descent, young men in Africa, or people who've had organ transplants. HIV-AIDS-related Kaposi sarcoma causes lesions to arise in more than one area of the body, including the skin, lymph nodes, and organs, such as the liver, spleen, lungs, and digestive tract. Kaposi sarcoma is not common in HIV patients in the United States, but it is extremely common in South Africa. It was far more common before we introduced our antiretroviral program, and the survival rate was also far lower then. In almost all cases, Kaposi sarcoma first presents on the skin of the upper and lower limbs. This would make sense, with Ntuli suddenly needing crutches. Ntuli was young, but if he'd contracted HIV in his early 20s, for instance, and had not been on a proper ARV program, he may well have been very ill by the time he was arrested. So I think when we consider whether Pilani Ntuli could really have died from what was referred to as skin cancer, the answer is absolutely yes, he could have. Because firstly, this was not a little mole on his shoulder, and his immune system would have already been hugely depleted. Now, on the other side of this, is it possible that Ntuli faked his death? Well, anything is possible. He could have paid off people to stage the identification. It would not be unheard of. In order for me to personally be convinced of this, though, I'd like to see some more evidence, because this was a really high-profile case, and although our justice system is far from uncorruptible, there surely would have been checks and balances in place, and could all of those points have been corrupted? Maybe, but for me, there is more evidence pointing to the fact that Kaposi sarcoma is what took the man's life. The case was, of course, struck off the roll, and police convinced that Ntuli had definitely been their man, closed Siam's case. For me, one resounding question remains that I would love answered at some point. If this case had indeed proceeded to trial, what chance did the state have of actually successfully prosecuting Pilani Ntuli? For me, I don't have many doubt that he did indeed kill Siam Lee, but that's just my personal opinion. There's enough evidence to point to him as the perpetrator. But in a trial, it's not about what you know. It's about what you can prove. And to prove something, you need evidence. Admissible evidence. Given that it's appeared to be common cause that warrants were not obtained to search Ntuli's house, at the very least, we don't actually know whether that extends to the removal of the vehicle and his actual arrest too. Would the state really have been able to prove Ntuli's guilt? Was his death actually a bit of a stroke of luck? Of course, no one's death is lucky. For the states, in that they would never have to prove their case. Of course, there may have been evidence we aren't aware of. That's entirely possible. But it is really worrying that an investigation that started off seeming to have little regard for the safety of the victim seems to have degenerated into a muddy mess when it came to the crux. After the death of her daughter's murderer, Nan Lee left KZN and moved to Bloemfontein. She told reporters at the time that she was planning on attending a rehab facility, but didn't specify what the treatment would be for. She also said she wanted to write a book about her and Siam's life, so that everyone could know the truth about who her daughter was and what had led to her murder. After this, Nan Lee has completely dropped off the map, and no one seems to know where she is. There are quite a few weird coincidences in this case, which only serve to increase the mystery level. You'll remember I told you to keep in mind the date on which Howard Greenspan, Siam Lee's father, was murdered. Yeah, it was the 4th of January, the same day, 13 years later, that Siam was abducted. Another weird coincidence is that in 2016, Siam did a photo shoot with a friend that she posted on Instagram. It was in a cane field. In a photo she posted, she's laying flat on her back staring blankly at the sky above her. The caption reads, "Don't mind me. I'm just laying in a field waiting to be abducted." Now, I'm pretty sure the quirky Siam meant abducted by aliens. But there's no doubt, given what would occur just 2 years later, that photo really was an odd harbinger of things to come. The last strange connection, although more just really sad than in any way coincidental, is the murder of Jessica Wires in 2020. To explain how Jessica fits into Siam's case, we need to rewind back to when Siam was still missing. MobiClaw, the organization assisting Nan Lee at the time, had received a tip that Siam had been seen at another establishment offering sex work in the KZN area. MobiClaw tracked this lead, and it led to a young woman who at the time was referred to by the pseudonym Jane. MobiClaw immediately verified that this was not Siam, but took the opportunity to interview the woman in the hopes that she may be able to provide some information. They say that what she revealed to them was terrifying and pointed to a possible human trafficking ring operating in the sex trade in KZN. The following is a quote from their article about their meeting with Jane. Quote, "Jane is estimated to be in her late 20s, in her own right very attractive, save for her teeth that have been rotted by drugs. She very quickly softens up to us when she realizes that we're not there for her and looking for a missing girl and invites us into her flat. This is a hard, streetwise girl. Doesn't pull any punches with her mouth, says it like it is. But we note little things. She has a cat. This cat loves her and won't leave her. There is a bedraggled Christmas tree in one corner. You soon realize this girl has a heart, and somewhere deep in there, she's hurting and wanting for more. But the drugs have captured her soul." End quote. In 2020, Jessica Wires was found murdered with her hands removed in Durban. The members of MobiClaw immediately recognized Jessica as Jane, their source from 2018. Articles that covered Jessica's case relied heavily on this angle, espousing "insider in Siam Lee case found murdered." Of course, this was just a way to ride on the public opinion that Pilani Ntuli was not really dead, and perhaps insert some intrigue around whether Jessica's death could somehow be linked. Of course, the truth around Jessica being an insider in Siam's investigation was that she really wasn't. Yes, MobiClaw had spoken to her at the time, but only because of a case of mistaken identity, and the information she'd given the investigators hadn't been linked specifically to Siam's case at all. Funny how headlines can be weaponized to make us think something when something entirely different is true. Jessica's case, of course, highlights the serious threat of violence that sex workers live under. And it also highlights how, even if police are all in on solving a case, considering most murders of sex workers are committed by people who are relative strangers to them, it is extremely difficult to apprehend the killer. Siam's case was different because Pilani Ntuli had ingratiated himself into her life. There's absolutely no proof that she really owed him 50,000 rand. And even if she did, his actions do not correlate with a loan. Also, Pilani seemed to be a pretty savvy businessman. Why would he lend a 20-year-old girl he barely knew that kind of money, even if she was attractive? There was a lot of public interest in Siam's case, but I really think it was for all the wrong reasons. The sex work aspect drew the most attention, And it was Siam's angelic looks, really, and her mother's alleged involvement in grooming her that made that aspect gawk-worthy for the public. If those aspects had not been present, if Siam hadn't been the graduate of a private school, would her case have gotten as much attention as it did? If Siam had been a long-time sex worker on the streets, addicted to drugs and stuck in a negative cycle, would anyone have even known her name? That is the one aspect of this case that is worth pondering. But the truth is, Siam deserved as much attention as the next person. But she didn't deserve the labels and indictments that went with it. She certainly didn't deserve to become a one-dimensional representation of how society chose to remember her. Personally, I don't see any value in blaming Nan Lee. Although she's made statements in the past that seem to attempt to downplay her own responsibility in her daughter being involved in sex work, I do think that Nan lives with deep guilt every day of her life. And the anger of strangers won't change that. The other side of this is, did Siam really die because she was involved in the sex trade? Yes, the man who's believed to have killed her did meet her that way, and it's unlikely she would have crossed paths with Ntuli any other way. But the more I dug down into the bare bones of this case, the more I started to notice the deep similarities with the murder of Erin van Rensburg. I covered Erin's case in episode 99 of the podcast. Erin was murdered by a man who'd become obsessed with her and whose advances she'd turned down. She had met the man quite by chance and did nothing to invite his obsession. Despite this, her killer targeted her and planned her rape and murder. He discarded her body in the sand dunes on the Cape's west coast. Her killer had also harassed her by text and continuously tried to make arrangements to see her. Erin had used exactly the same words as Siam to describe the man who would eventually take her life. Creepy. Weird. But Erin was not a sex worker. She was a university student. But both women fell victim to predators. So what is the common denominator here? Not sex work. Not being a university student. The common denominator is that they were women who each found themselves in the path of a man who believed that his needs and desires were worth more than their lives. And as much as it might be tempting to focus on the salacious bits of this case and lay blame at the doors we think it belongs at, that's actually too easy. Because Siam's murder is very simple. Siam is Erin. Erin is Siam. Two completely different young women with two very different backgrounds and identical endings. Siam was much more than we've ever been introduced to. She was a deeply complex person who cannot and should not be defined by the way she earned money in the last few months of her life. In covering Siam's case, I desperately wanted to have a deeper insight to share with you into who she was and how we should be remembering her. So I reached out to a few of the people who'd asked me to cover Siam's case. People who knew Siam. Not people who think they knew her because they read about her once in an article. Two such women responded to me and wrote beautiful pieces about Siam that they've agreed I can share with you, and I'd like to do so to end this episode. The first is by Emma Backman and reads as follows. Quote, I met Siam in 2014. We had a few mutual friends, but our friendship didn't blossom until later that same year. I was an aspiring photographer back then. and had these crazy artistic photo shoots I wanted to do. Siam was the only person who believed in me and understood my creativity. After our first photo shoot together, it was like I was blessed with an older sister. She was a great mentor and someone who I could ask questions to without any judgment. I will never forget the day I heard Siam had gone missing. I tried staying positive. I remember still thinking, she's just run off with a boy somewhere. It's such a Siam thing to do. But when I heard they'd found her body, my life came crashing down. She was such an inspiring person who had always had time for the people she cared for. I miss her dearly, and every few months dive deep into her case, hoping to maybe find something that someone has missed. Anyone who knew her would say the same thing. She was the warmest soul, and you couldn't stop smiling when she entered the room. She was an absolute ray of sunshine in anybody's life. End quote. Emma has also kindly shared a few photographs from those quirky photo shoots with Siam, which I'll share on Instagram. Emma has gone on to become a professional photographer, and I think that's a pretty cool part of Siam's legacy. The second piece I want to share with you was written by T. I know her full name, but I'm not sure if she'd want me to share it, so I'll just go with how she signed off her piece. T is what I would call a victim's advocate. She's an insanely strong young woman who is talented and caring and super smart. She, I believe, is who Siam would have been had she had the opportunity. T wants to work in activism against human trafficking, and she has some seriously amazing ideas about how to combine technology with law to create solutions to help combat human trafficking. As a sidebar, and T is probably going to shout at me for doing this, but I'm going to anyway, T is currently trying to fund furthering her law studies, and she's struggling as she's seen as too old for bursaries. She's in her 20s. So if anyone out there has a couple of extra 100,000 rand lying around or access to a grant or bursary, please reach out and I'll put you in touch with this incredible young woman. I think that would be another pretty amazing way to honor Siam. So here to end out the episode is T's dedication to her friend Siam Lee. I met Siam Lee at Crawford North Coast. We went to the same high school together. I was 2 or 3 years older than her, and I've never been so honored to have made a friend like Siam. If someone were to ask me how I would describe Siam's personality, I'd say she was friendly, quirky, and extremely animated. I treasured taking the school bus with her when it was time to head home because we would talk about the most funniest and randomest things that kept us entertained. Her nickname was the Siamese Cat, not only because the nickname was a comical extension of her first name, but because she was unconventionally beautiful. Her expressive eyes stood out the most, which blended very well with her animated personality. When I first heard of Siam's missing case, I was in severe shock. I left to a different high school very suddenly and never received the opportunity to say goodbye to her. One day I randomly came across her photo on my Instagram page and I immediately blurted out her name out of excitement, as I saw the opportunity to catch up with an old friend. It took me a minute to realize it was a missing poster of her being illustrated. When the case was finally concluded as a murder case, it drove me to tears. The brutality that Siam experienced was too much to handle, particularly when this was experienced by a young girl I had known in person. I think all my former peers and classmates were equally as traumatized as I was. I remember when I'd heard of Siam being murdered, I got in touch with a peer and we were both breaking down. Siam will be greatly missed and loved forevermore. My regret is not saying goodbye to her when I left our high school, and just thanking her for being such a beautiful girl who had brought nothing but good memories to me and treated me well in my entire high school journey. Rest in peace. Power and grace, beautiful girl. Thank you for everything. And I'm sorry the world will never get to experience the pure joy you brought to me and many others at Crawford North Coast and beyond. T. Siam Lee, rest gently.
Updates on episode 100 as at December 2025. It's been exactly 3 years since I covered Siam Lee's case on the podcast. This was originally episode 100, and I'm about to release episode 200 in the next few weeks. And Siam's case remains one that stays with me. After I released the episode, I got a really big response, especially from people who had known and loved Siam. I did receive some communication from the family of Siam's dad as well. They were grateful that I'd covered Siam's case and expressed how deeply sad they'd been when they'd heard of her murder. The family member shared some clarifying information with me around the financial situation between Howard and Nan for Siam's education, and how that had really been impacted after he had died. Unfortunately, I can't share that info here. Firstly, because they did not give me permission to do so, but also because I haven't been able to get Nan's side of the story, which would only be fair, for reasons I'll explain in a bit. Suffice to say, though, things aren't always as clear-cut as they seem, and there are definitely always two sides to a story. Speaking of Nan, I actually also received a few emails from people who had dated her throughout her life, and that was a really mixed bag. Most spoke of her really fondly and said she was a good person, albeit a little scattered. One or two did have some negative experiences with her, and I think that's to be expected with anyone. I also got some feedback from Brad Nathanson, the private investigator I mentioned in the episode. He was very complimentary of the episode and said I'd got the facts right, which is always good to hear. I often find myself revising my opinion about things as I learn more about the world of crime. And one aspect of my opinion about the offender in this case has shifted since I first covered this episode. When I discussed the death of Pelani Ntuli and the theories that were being bandied around about him possibly having faked his death, I think back in 2022 I was quite dismissive of these claims. That was because I honestly still thought that despite many of our systems clearly being very corrupt, I just didn't believe that someone would be able to buy their way through so many levels of different departments to ensure that they could get away with faking their death. And now, in 2025, let's just say I'm no longer absolutely certain about that. On the balance of probabilities, I do still think Pelani Ntuli is probably dead. But I cannot help but think about what Thabo Bester managed to arrange, and I definitely now accept the possibility that Pelani may have been able to do the same. Pelani wasn't even incarcerated when he died, and he was a pretty successful businessman, and by all accounts, well-connected. While I truly hope it is not the case, I must now soften my stronger opinion from the original episode and admits that, yes, actually, there is a possibility he may have faked his death, and it clearly is entirely possible to achieve. On the 7th of May 2025, news broke that Carmen Nan Lee had passed away. Her cause of death was not shared, but it does appear to have been as a result of natural causes. On the Post, private investigator Brad Nathanson shared about her passing on his Facebook page. The comments remained divided. Many simply shared their condolences on her passing and said that she would now be reunited with her daughter. Others, though, continued to express their view that Nan was complicit in her daughter's death. Still others were taken back to the time when Siam's case was headline news, and many expressed their doubts that Pilani Ntuli actually died in 2019. A few of Nan's friends commented on the post too, with happy memories of their friend. One Facebook profile which seemed to be involved in arranging Nan's funeral had commented when her funeral was going to be held, and then a few days later mentioned that it had been one of the saddest funerals they'd ever attended, and they wished more people had gone. Nan died while living in the Eastern Cape, and although I have no idea whether her funeral was held there, I would imagine, considering she'd been a KZN resident for most of her life, many of her friends and acquaintances may not have been able to make it. After Pilani Ntuli had died and the final court hearing was held to officially remove the case from the roll, Nan had told a journalist that she planned to move to Asia and write a book about her daughter's life. I don't know whether she ever got around to doing that in the 6 years that elapsed between that moment and her own death. I've been approached to develop several different projects around Siam's murder over the years. None of them have ever come to fruition. But even now, I think there's so much more that could be told in the story. And maybe one day, I'll find a suitable way to do that. For now, Siam's story is at rest. Although, I can't quite seem to ditch the thought that if her killer really didn't die in 2019, maybe her story continues without us knowing. Maybe there are more like her out there. And also, more like him. And that is your Rewind episode for episode 100 of True Crime South Africa, the murder of Siam Lee. I hope you found value in this Rewind episode, and I'll chat to you soon.